So this paper I know has been distributed perhaps to some of you beforehand, and maybe someone has even read parts of it, but I will not presume any prior reading. It's too long to read the whole of it. It's over 30 pages. So I decided to read the first half, where I sort of first criticize a certain interpretation of Ascombe and then present my own interpretation of Ascombe. And then, if discussion turns into matters that I discuss later in the paper, I would be happy to discuss them as well. But I think it would be appropriate to read the first half, which will take around 40 minutes, I think. But first I thought I would make a warming up exercise, because I realized that I use certain terminology here which might not be self-evident. And in particular, I talk about something called the openness of the progressive. I think we can say that Anscombe's philosophy of action, there's been a big renaissance for Anscombe's philosophy of action in recent years. And maybe the most important explanation of that is the publication of Michael Thompson's work, which was a long time on available on the internet, but was published in 2008 as a book. And in particular, I'm thinking of the second chapter of that book called Naive Action Theory. And recent work in connection with Thompson and Anscombe can be characterized, I think much recent philosophy of action in the analytic tradition actually can be characterized by saying that there is a rediscovery of the progressive. And what's that? I mean, one can say it's to put it very simply, it's a rediscovery of the fact that action is a process that takes time and has a special structure due to that fact. Whereas in sort of Davidsonian paradigm, actions are treated as, so to speak, atomic units that could as well be momentary. In recent work, one has tended to emphasize the fact that actions are stretched out in time. And this is related to an important point about action descriptions, namely that they can have two different aspects, as linguists have for a long time noted. Okay. So if we think about, first, if we take two different ways of talking about actions in the present tense, we can say either that Paula walked to school, or we can say, using the progressive form, Paula was walking to school. And the difference between these two descriptions, it's not a difference in tense, they are both in the past tense, but the difference is that here we describe Paula's action as one finished event, whereas here we're talking about it as an event in progression, so to speak. And one important difference here is then that this way of talking about Paula's action, which is called to talk about it in the perfective aspect. Okay. This way of talking entails that Paula actually got to school, right? She completed her action, right? She arrived at the school in the proper order, so to speak. Okay. So the action was completed in that sense. Whereas when we talk about it in an imperfective way, that description doesn't entail that Paula actually came to school. So you can say Paula was walking to school, but unfortunately she was hit by a car and got killed before she got to school, right? Okay. And that's called the openness of the progressive. Okay. And then questions arise, of course. In what sense is she walking to school if she never got there? How can we say that she was walking to school, right? And of course we want to explain that in terms of her intention somehow, but exactly how that explanation looks is going to be a difficult matter, especially considering that other events that aren't actions are also open. So if we say the tree is falling over, or the, yeah, I think that's that's Anscombe's example. That's also, let's stay with the past tense. The tree was falling over. Doesn't imply that it actually fell to the ground. You can say the tree was falling over, but I stopped it. But, or, you know, it was, you know, there was another tree in the way, so it never fell over or something like that. Okay. So in this case, we want to talk about her intention when we want to explain how it comes that she was walking to school, even if she might never have gotten there. But in this case, we don't ascribe intentions to trees, so there has to be some other way of explaining how it could still be, you know, falling over. Here we want something, maybe we don't want a teleological account. Okay, but that's, I'm not going to go any deeper into this, but this is the kind of issue I'm referring to when, at a couple of places, I'm talking about the openness of the progressive, and it will matter to my criticism of Moran and Stone's reading of Anscombe. One might note that it's impossible to use the perfective aspect in the present tense. So we can say Paula is walking to school. But if we try to say, to describe this in a perfective aspect in the present tense, we might try by saying Paula walks to school, for example. But that isn't. That's actually a way of talking about Paula's habits. I mean, she has the habit of, you know, going by foot to school. But it's not actually a description of one particular action of Paula in the present tense. And a common criticism nowadays of Davidson and other philosophers of action in his tradition is that they treat this as if it was a description of some sort of, as if you can talk about actions in the sort of way you try to talk about them here but fail, so to speak. So this, that's a common criticism nowadays of Davidson. Okay. Well, that's an interesting fact. I can say a lot more about this, but I won't go into that now. We can talk about it in discussion if you want. Okay, did this make sense to you? Okay. Okay, good. Okay, so I'll read the first half of the paper. In intention, paragraph 2, Elizabeth Anscombe writes, and this is quotation 1 on the handout, intention appears to be something that we can express, but which brutes, which for example do not give orders, can have, though lacking any distinct expression of intention. For a cat's movements in stalking a bird are hardly to be called an expression of intention. One might as well call a car's stalling the expression of its being about to stop. Intention is unlike emotion in this respect, that the expression of it is purely conventional, we might say linguistic, if we will allow certain bodily movements with a conventional meaning to be included in language. Wittgenstein seems to me to have gone wrong in speaking of the natural expression of an intention. And that's quoted from Philosophical Investigations 647. This passage has puzzled several commentators, and understandably so. Anscombe seems to offer little by way of argument for her claim that a cat's movements in stalking a bird, and similarly natural, non-conventional manifestations of intention, are not to be counted as expressions of intention. It's certainly true that a cat's movements in stalking a bird do not amount to what is sometimes called a personal expression of intention. It's not the cat which is expressing an intention by means of its movements, as when a man is expressing his intention by saying, "I'm going to catch that bird." However, expression in this personal sense is not the only sort of expression there is. Impersonal expressions are both possible and common, as when a man's face expresses sadness, even if he doesn't intend to look sad. And why not conceive the cat's movements along similar lines? The worry arises that Anscombe is offering little more than a somewhat eccentric and philosophically unmotivated stipulation to the effect that linguistic and similarly conventional expressions of intention are the only things she's going to call expressions of intention. My overall aim in this paper is to explain why I think there is more to Anscombe's criticism of Wittgenstein than such a merely stipulative restriction of usage. I look not only at Anscombe's work, but also at the most extensive commentary on Intention Paragraph 2 and related paragraphs to date, Richard Moran's and Martin Stone's recent paper, Anscombe on Expression of Intention. I'll suggest that Moran and Stone failed to see the possibility of what I take to be the most straightforward reading of the passage. So my presentation here will have a very simple structure. I identify the basic mistake in Moran's and Stone's reading of section 2 in Intention, and after that I'll provide my own positive account of Anscombe's viewpoint. Okay. So, why Moran's and Stone's reading of paragraph 2 doesn't work? Following Anscombe's terminology, I shall say that a creature is a language user and has a language if it can make use of conventional means of expression, including bodily movements with a conventional meaning. And given this idiom, Anscombe can be said to make at least the following two claims, I think, in Intention paragraph 2. First, having intentions does not require being a language user. And two, expressing intentions requires being a language user. Now, it seems clear that Anscombe thinks having intentions is possible only for a creature that can act intentionally, and vice versa. So I think we can also ascribe to her the view that having intentions and acting intentionally do not require being a language user. Further support for this reading can be found in Anscombe's 1979 paper, Under a Description, where she brings up the issue of animal intentionality again. This time, her example is one of a bird landing on a twig, so as to peck at birdseed, a twig which, unfortunately for the bird, is smeared with bird lime. Now, even English native speakers tend to ask me what bird lime is. I don't, but it's, you smear it on a branch, and birds who land there get stuck there. Fogelklister, something like that. Regarding this particular landing, Anscombe says the following, and this is number 2 on your handout. So landing on the twig was landing on bird lime. We aren't considering two different landings. So if we form the definite descriptions, the action then of landing on the twig, the action then of landing on a twig with bird lime on it, we must say they are definite descriptions satisfied by the same occurrence, which was something that the bird did. But under the one description, it was intentional. Under the other, unintentional. That the bird is not a language user has no bearing on this. So from this passage and the passage from Intention quoted earlier, I think we can safely conclude that Anscombe subscribes to both the thesis I formulated earlier, that having intentions and acting intentionally does not require being a language user, whereas expressing an intention requires being a language user. Okay. Now, the reading of Intention paragraph 2, offered by Moran and Stone, makes it very difficult to account for Anscombe's subscribing to both these claims. According to Moran's and Stone's Anscombe, the basic reason why the behavior of a creature with no language cannot express intentions is that such behavior is normatively inert. It conveys no standards of success and failure and doesn't point toward any further commitments on the part of the agent. By contrast, Moran and Stone argue, and this is passage 3 on the handout, when an intention is verbalized, it specifies the performance to which the agent is committed in the future or in which he is already engaged, and that performance may then be judged correct or mistaken in light of what is expressed. Now, it's difficult to find any clear basis in Anscombe's writings for this distinction between the normative inertness of natural behavioral manifestations of intentions and the normative force of linguistic conventional expressions of intention. Certainly, she does seem to say things to the effect that an intention is an essentially normative sort of unit, that intending such and such involves being subject to standards of correctness in performance. However, this notion doesn't entail that such normativity can be exhibited only linguistically. Rather, it seems to suggest that an intention determines commitments and standards of correctness in virtue of its being the intention it is, regardless of whether it is linguistically expressed or manifested in non-linguistic behavior. So, even if one agrees that intentions are normative, why argue that non-linguistic behavioral manifestations of intentions do not exhibit or convey the relevant standards of correctness? Why insist, as Moran and Stone puts it, that expressions of intention have a normative force that no bit of natural behavior could have? That is number four on the handout. Isn't it more coherent to say that since certain bits of natural behavior manifest intentions, those bits of behavior do manifest standards of correctness and point toward further commitments on the part of the agent? Indeed, if these bits of behavior did not exhibit such standards and did not point toward further commitments, then how could they manifest intentions at all, if intentions are essentially normative? Would not the alleged lack of normative force in non-linguistic behavior entail that non-linguistic creatures neither express nor manifest intentions? And if they do neither of these things, what is the basis for saying that they have any intentions to begin with? Martin and Stone, however, insists that, quote, and this is number five on the handout, considered apart from their verbal expressibility, intentions are sunk in facticity. This is why Anscombe suggests an analogy between the movements of the cat as a basis for attributing intentions and the car's stalling engine. Just as the engine's behavior indicates that the car is going to stop only if the car is going to stop, so the movements of the cat indicate only what it actually goes on to do. End of quote. I'll come back to Anscombe's parallel between the cat and the car later. I think Moran and Stone completely misunderstands that parallel. But what interests me now is Moran's and Stone's way of spelling out the normative inertness of non-linguistic manifestations of intention in terms of a distinction which is crucial to Anscombe, that between mistake of judgment and mistake of performance. Anscombe is well known for holding that in cases where the agent acts in contravention of what his intention requires, it is his performance rather than the intention which is at fault, in contrast to cases where the agent's belief is not in accordance with how things are, in which case it is the belief that is at fault and not the world. So in modern lingo, you talk about a different, they have opposite directions of fit, right? Intentions and beliefs. Okay. It's questionable whether that term is really a good one to use to characterize Anscombe's position, but at least it might be helpful anyway here. So what Moran and Stone are arguing is that linguistic expressions are needed for this difference to make sense. According to them, natural, non-conventional manifestations of intention can never fault subsequent performances. Quote, and this is number six on your handout, only when intention is not merely indicated, but verbalized as a statement of what one is doing, do we see how its expression could be something in light of which a performance might be mistaken or corrected. For only a statement, a claim upon the world established independently of the regularities it seeks to track, could be in a position to impugn the facts. If this is right, it would follow that if a speechless brute whose behavior seems to manifest a certain intention later behaves in some fashion that doesn't fit that intention, there will be no reason to say that the latter performance is mistaken. Instead, it would seem that since the movements of such a brute, quote, indicate only what it actually goes on to do, to cite the earlier quoted passage, such apparent deviance at a later point should make us conclude that the brute's intention turned out to be different from what the earlier behavior let us expect. Notice the incompatibility between this claim and what Anscombe says about the bird. Anscombe says that landing on a twig with bird lime on it is a description under which the bird's behavior is unintentional. And she says this despite the fact that what the bird actually goes on to do is landing on a twig with bird lime on it. Let's suppose that the bird never gets so far as pecking at the birdseed nearby, since it is first occupied with trying to get loose and is then killed. If Moran and Stone are right, Anscombe should correct her initial claim, saying instead that the bird never intended to peck at birdseed, and that what it did intentionally was landing on a twig smeared with birdlime. But clearly she doesn't consider that a viable option. And with good reason, for this way of depriving the bird's behavior of its normative consequences actually means that the very notion of its being a manifestation of the bird's intention disappears from view. If all that non-linguistic behavioral manifestations can give us are hypotheses subject to correction in light of what happens later, there is no reason at all to call such bits of behavior manifestations of intentions. Perhaps vaguely sensing that their account undermines the very possibility of non-linguistic manifestations of intentions, Moran and Stone do acknowledge that, quote, this is number 7 on your handout, we can sometimes see directly that someone is naturally barking up the wrong tree, say merely running the brush along the wall when they mean to be painting the room yellow. But, they add, here it is important that we grasp a particular description of what they are doing or intending to do, one which a human being could give in answer to the question, why? End of quote. This in no way resolves the difficulty, however, for what is supposed to decide which action description is the appropriate one for us to grasp? Moran's and Stone's idea seems to be that it's only in virtue of the fact that humans can answer the why question on an animal's behalf that the animal's behavior can be identified as the manifestation of a determinate intention. But this seems to put the cart before the horse, for what would be the basis for such an answer if the behavior doesn't manifest any intention to begin with, independently of the answer given? If it is our answering the question on the animal's behalf that makes the animal's behavior express the intention specified in the answer, then it seems any answer would do, since the answer doesn't report, but in effect lays down which intention is being manifested. So, Moran's and Stone's attempt to explain why Anscombe insists that intentions can only be expressed by conventional means cannot be correct. In fact, Anscombe holds a view quite contrary to the one ascribed to her by Moran and Stone, a view they seem to assume cannot reasonably be held. In direct contravention of their claim that, quote, expressions of intention have a normative force that no bit of natural behavior could have, Anscombe is perfectly happy to say that natural behavior can have the sort of normative force that is required for them to constitute manifestations of intention. This is an element in her form of Aristotelianism. She takes the identification of an animal's intention to rely on a background conception of what is good for the animal as an animal of its kind. Thus, according to Anscombe, in saying that the bird is acting with the intention to peck at birdseed, we are relying on the conception that pecking at birdseed is a good thing to do for birds of this sort. So it's evident that the bird in the example cannot be a sea eagle, for example. Conversely, in saying that the bird's behavior is unintentional under the description landing on a twig with birdlime on it, we are presuming that getting stuck in birdlime is a hindrance rather than conducive to the fulfillment of aims that the bird has, qua a bird of its kind. In passing, Moran and Stone do note that in saying of the bird that it lands on a twig in order to peck at birdseed, we, quote, seek a description that makes what the bird did comprehensible within what we know the bird is seeking. And that, quote, a reference to the agent and its good does operate as a constraint here. This is number 8 on your handout. But they never develop this idea any further and don't tie it to Anscombe's substantively Aristotelian conception of the realm of the living. If they did, the tension with their leading idea about how to interpret Anscombe's claim that expressions of intentions are linguistic conventional would soon become apparent. Now, it is of course true that even if one accepts a sort of general Aristotelian approach to the realm of the living and thinks of the behavior of living things in terms of what is good for them as members of certain species, it is by no means evident that one would have to say that animals such as birds and cats have intentions. Aristotelianism in this broad sense of the word is fully compatible with the idea that the sort of normativity involved in intentions are too sophisticated, too imbued with full-fledged rationality to be present in speechless brutes. After all, Anscombe would not ascribe intentions to a plant, even if she would be willing to explain its activity too, in terms of what is good for it, qua a plant of a certain kind, a sunflower, say. So it seems that she must present some more substantive account of the relevant difference between plants and sufficiently advanced animals in order to clarify her preparedness to say of cats and birds that they have intentions and act intentionally. Now, Anscombe isn't as explicit here as one might have wished. But there are a couple of places where she motivates her conception. In paragraph 47 of Intention, she first notes that animal behavior exhibits a progressive structure typical for intentional action. This is number 9 on your handout. Quote, "We describe what animals do in a manner perfectly characteristic of the use of intention concepts. We describe what further they are doing in doing something. The cat is stalking a bird, in crouching and slinking along with its eyes fixed on the bird and its whiskers twitching." End of quote. And she also emphasizes the importance of the capacity for perception. So if someone asks, why is the cat crouching and slinking like that? The fact that the cat's eye is fixed on a bird is an important motivation for the answer, it's stalking that bird. In a later paper, she emphasizes how animal behavior displays responsiveness not only to present sensory objects, but also to prospective consequences. This capacity to relate to what is not already there, she calls imagination. For example, to say of a dog which leaps about with enthusiasm as his lead is produced, to say of him that he hopes to be taken for a walk, is to ascribe imagination to the dog. Sunflowers, by contrast, have no imagination. Quote, "Standing in ranks, sunflowers uniformly turn their faces to the sun, not to where the sun will be before it is there." End of quote. And similarly, an animal can look for something and then fail or succeed in finding it, whereas a plant never fails or succeeds in such a sense, but only responds to what is already present. Now, sketchy as Anscombe's explanations may be, I think they suffice to show that in contravention of the central idea of Morantz and Stone's interpretation, her contrast between conventional and non-conventional behavior cannot usefully be accounted for in terms of a difference between being normative and being sunk in facticity. Indeed, her willingness to ascribe intentions to speechless brutes clearly shows that she thinks the normativity of their non-conventional, non-linguistic behavior can be rich and sophisticated enough for such behavior to count as the manifestation of determinate intentions. Of course, this in no way explains why Anscombe insists that non-conventional animal behavior does not express intentions. Indeed, if she's happy to say that such behavior has enough normative force to manifest intentions, then why on earth does she nonetheless deny that it can express intentions? What we have learned so far is only that her reason for denying this must lie somewhere else than where Moran and Stone find it. Let us now turn to the task of providing a positive account of her viewpoint. So what then is Anscombe's point in saying that expressions of intention can only be linguistic or conventional? Let's go back to her parallel between the cat's stalking and the car's stalling. According to Anscombe, calling a cat's movements in stalking a bird an expression of intention is no better than calling a car's stalling the expression of its being about to stop. At first sight, her point here might seem to be that the cat's behavior is as non-normative as the car's stalling, and that the reason why neither the cat's nor the car's behavior expresses any intention is simply that they are not intentional at all. In the previous section, I argued that Morantz and Stone's claim that the cat's and the car's behaviors are both sunk in facticity is in effect a variety of this sort of reading, even if they shy away from the inevitable corollary that the cat's behavior manifests no intention and is not intentional. The corollary clearly shows that what we have here is a misreading, since Anscombe is unequivocal that many animals have intentions and act intentionally, and she clearly thinks that the cat's movements in her example manifests an intention. So Anscombe's point must be quite different. The key here, I think, is to notice and understand the real significance of the progressive form of the descriptions at issue, A cat is stalking a bird and is thus about to catch it. The car is stalling and is thus about to stop. The stalking and the stalling are both steps towards the end point or completion of a process. The cat is on its way towards being in possession of the bird, and the car is on its way towards standing still. Not that these end points must in fact be reached, right? That's the openness. Moran and Stone are thus quite wrong to say that the cars and the cat's movements, quote, indicate only what the car or the cat actually go on to do. The progressive descriptions at issue are as open as other progressives and may well be true even if the bird escapes or if the car's engine suddenly starts working properly and the car never comes to a standstill. If so, the processes are interrupted before completion. It is true that the being about to and being on its way towards need to be spelled out in different ways in the two cases. In the case of the cat, it will be spelled out in terms of the cat's intention to catch the bird. In the case of the car, it will be spelled out in terms of the mechanics of the car engine, with no reference to intentions or any other form of goal-directedness. To have an end point, a point of completion, is not necessarily to have a goal. But there is still the following crucial similarity. The cat's behavior in stalking the bird is itself part of the process which has as its end point the cat's being in possession of the bird. And the car's stalling is itself part of the process which has as its endpoint the car's standing still. And now my suggestion is that Anscombe thinks conventional expressions of intentions differ from natural manifestations of intentions in that they are not, in this sense, parts of the processes leading up to the achievement of the intended goal. So my suggestion, this is my sort of key suggestion, that Anscombe thinks conventional expressions of intentions differ from natural expressions, the natural manifestations of intentions, in that they are not, in this sense, parts of the processes leading up to the achievement of the intended goal. Okay, so consider Anscombe's bird, which is landing intentionally on a twig in order to peck at birdseed. The intention to peck at birdseed is the intention with which the bird is landing on the twig. How does the bird manifest this intention to peck at birdseed? Well, precisely by landing on the twig, sitting on which will allow the bird to peck at seed nearby. So the bird manifests its intention to peck at birdseed precisely by doing something in order to peck at birdseed. The manifestation of the intention to peck at birdseed is part of the bird's ongoing project of getting some birdseed to peck at. And it is precisely qua being a step taken towards the aim of pecking at birdseed that the twig landing manifests the intention to peck at birdseed. The same is true when humans manifest rather than express their intentions. That is, when they manifest their intentions in non-linguistic, non-conventional ways. Thus, I may manifest my intention to turn on the TV by picking up the remote control. Picking up the remote control is something I do in order to turn on the TV. It is meant to take me one step further towards my intended goal. Similarly, I may manifest my intention to make coffee by grinding some coffee beans. In this case, too, the action which manifests my intention is intended to bring me closer to my intended goal. Grinding the beans is something I do in order to make coffee. And someone who is pumping water may thereby manifest his intention to replenish the water supply precisely by doing something in order to replenish the water supply, namely pumping water. So, in somewhat rough and preliminary terms, I think we can draw the following general conclusion. When an intention to achieve a certain aim is manifested by non-conventional, non-linguistic means, the manifestation consists in an action which is itself part of the endeavor to achieve the intended goal. So an action phi manifests an intention to psi only if phi-ing is supposed to be a step taken in order to psi. So the bird's landing on the twig manifests the bird's intention to peck at birdseed by being done in order to peck at birdseed. My picking up the remote control manifests my intention to turn on the TV by being done with the aim of turning on the TV. The pumper's pumping manifests his intention to replenish the water supply by being done in order to replenish the water supply, and so on and so forth. Now, things are very different with conventional linguistic expressions of intentions. my saying I intend to make coffee or I'm going to make coffee expresses my intention to make coffee, but is not meant to take me any further towards getting the coffee made. A recipe for how to make coffee may well instruct you to grind some coffee beans, but it will certainly not instruct you to utter the words, I intend to make coffee. That's not part of the recipe. Such an utterance is ineffectual as far as the production of coffee is concerned. Similarly, my saying that I intend to turn on the TV is quite ineffectual as far as getting the TV turned on is concerned. And the water supply will remain quite empty as long as our pumper is merely stating his intention to replenish it. Earlier, I quoted from intention paragraph 47, where Anscombe notes that, quote, we describe what animals do in a manner perfectly characteristic of the use of intention concepts. We describe what further they are doing in doing something. Notice how well this passage fits the reading I'm offering here. The ascription of intentions to animals, says Anscombe, is a matter of describing what further they are doing in already doing something. Whereas in the case of language-using agents, there is yet another possibility present. We can say of such an agent, on the basis of what he says, that he intends something he is not already pursuing. So whereas a non-conventional manifestation of an intention to fi is already part of the ongoing endeavor to realize the intention to fi, conventional expressions of intentions do not, in that sense, interlock with the practical project whose aim they are stating. I can express my intention to fi without yet having done anything in order to fi. And if I have done something in order to fi, what I have done will be something else than my having merely said or otherwise expressed that I'm going to fi. In short, words are cheap, but that's also their great advantage. For with linguistic conventional means of expression come precisely the ability to stand at a distance from the actual pursuit of the envisaged goals. Instead of practical trial and error, such distance allows for sophisticated planning ahead of time, as well as extensive reflection on the viability and value of proposed projects. This is perhaps not to say that the absence of linguistic conventional means for the expression of intentions makes all forms of practical reasoning altogether impossible. However, it is certainly to say that such linguistic means open up an arena for incomparably advanced reasoning among agents who use them. This reading makes sense of Anscombe's parenthetical remark at the beginning of paragraph 2 that speechless brutes do not give orders. I mean, if you look again at paragraph 2, the number 1 on your handout, she says that in passing, brutes do not give orders, but I mean, it remains somewhat puzzling why she has that parenthetical remark. But I think my reading makes sense of it. This remark is pertinent because in typical cases, an order stands at the same sort of distance from its execution as a linguistic expression of intention stands from the execution of the expressed intention. Issuing an order is distinct from obeying it. Similarly, expressing an intention is distinct from acting in accordance with it. The reading I have suggested also fits well with Anscombe's claim that in contrast with expressions of intentions, expressions of emotions may well be non-conventional. For with respect to emotions, there is not the sort of teleological structure by reference to which the distinction between conventional expressions and non-conventional manifestations is made in the case of intentions. If my blushing reveals my nervousness, it's not because it constitutes a step towards my getting nervous or towards some other goal defined by my state of nervousness. Rather, it simply reveals the emotional state I am in. And Anscombe therefore feels free to say that my blushing is as expressive of that state as my saying, I'm terribly nervous. Which is not to deny that there are many other important differences between conventional and non-conventional modes of emotional expression, of course. Okay, so before I end the presentation, just by way of ending, I need to clarify two more things about the view I'm ascribing to Anscombe. First, for a piece of behavior to manifest an intention, it is enough if it constitutes an attempt to reach the intended goal, even if we can see that the attempt is hopeless. Thus, consider a fox struggling to get loose from a fox trap. We can see that the struggle is in vain, the hunter is already on his way, and the fox is doomed. Still, this must certainly be counted as a natural manifestation of intention, if anything is. So even if the fox's behavior doesn't actually take the fox any closer to its intended goal, it is certainly supposed to do so. And that suffices to make it different from expressions of intentions, which are typically not themselves supposed to be steps taken toward the intended goal. Admittedly, and this is the second point of clarification, there are expressions of intentions that are themselves supposed to be steps taken towards the achievement of the intended goal. Thus, suppose I tell you in a determinate tone of voice, I'm going to call my sister tonight. Suppose that besides serving as an expression of intention, I also intend my utterance to function as a means towards the fulfillment of the intention expressed by it. I utter the words in order to engrave them on my mind so I will actually call my sister tonight and not forget about it. Right? Such cases are not counterexamples to the view I'm ascribing to Anscombe. Rather, they make it clear what the view actually is. Such cases call for a distinction between the expressive function of the utterance and the function it has as a means to the intended goal. And they make clear that the former function is there independently of the latter. My utterance serves as an expression of intention, whether or not it also serves the additional purpose of engraving the uttered words on my mind so that I will not forget to call my sister. So the view I'm ascribing to Anscombe involves no denial that expressions of intentions can also, in addition to their expressive role, serve as means taken towards the intended end. The view is, in the first instance, a view about the expressive function rather than a general thesis about what functions individual expressions of intentions in fact have, or what other functions they might have. The claim is that the expressive function is there independently of whether expressing the intention also constitutes a step taken towards the intended end. Thus, it's actually misleading to state the view in terms of its being typically or normally the case that expressions of intention are not steps taken towards the intended goal, for even in the atypical cases, such as the example of my saying, I'm going to call my sister tonight, the distinction between the two roles remains as definite as ever. Okay, I think I'll stop there simply.